Do you know as much about the law as you should? Join us for the law game and find out. We'll be inviting three celebrities to judge the results of law cases and tell us how they came to those decisions. And here to keep order is the man who not only sits on the bench, he sleeps on it as well. Your chairman, Shaw Taylor.
Thank you very much indeed, ladies and gentlemen. A very good evening to you. Now, in the law game, we dramatize fictitious cases based on real ones that dealt with the same points of law. The parts are played by our multi-talented repertory company over here, who will act out each scene until they hear this bell. And that is the signal for me to challenge our panelists to say who won the case and why they won it. I'm also going to ask them to back their decisions by betting up to 50 points on them. Now, if they choose the right side, I'll award them the number of points they bet, and if they give me the right reason, they'll give them odds of 2-1. Now, court procedure is never strictly adhered to on this program because we want to speed things up, get in as many cases as we can. And I see facing me tonight a brand new panel. They are Lance Percival, Lisa Goddard, and John Junkin. Now, let's meet them one by one. Lance Percival.
What have I got
written down here? Yes, comedian, musician, actor, chairman of the show Wits End. Any brush with the law ever left you at your wits end at all?
Yes, when I was coming back from a cabaret one night, I was stopped by the police. And this policeman put up his hand and said, get out of the car. So I got out, being a proper citizen. He said, would you mind coming around the front, sir? So I came around the front. He said, have you noticed one of your headlamps is not working? So I said, oh, I was a bit worried about this. So I thought I'd try an emergency treatment and gave the headlamp a great kick with my left foot. And the headlamp came on again. Whereupon he said, fantastic, sir. He said, why don't you give it another kick and see if the tax disc comes up this time?
Our second panelist, Lisa Goddard. Now, I know something about you, Lisa, because I read in the reference book on Who's Who on television that your unfulfilled ambition is to ride across Afghanistan on a horse. Is that true?
Yes, but it was until the war happened and everything.
Oh, I see. Yes, this is pre-Russia.
Well, yes, it was.
Oh, well, I hope you make that ambition. But what about any fulfilled strange ambitions get you in trouble with the law at all at any point?
Well, only once when I was travelling across Siberia, which was another ambition before Afghanistan, and I got lost in Khabarovsk, a little village in Siberia, in the barracks. And I was looking for the cinema, and this policeman stopped me, and I didn't understand English, of course. And so I was explaining about the cinema, and I was trying to do all those signs that you do about the cinema, and he didn't understand. He took me back to the hotel, and I was terribly disappointed.
He was on location for Pig in the Middle.
John Junkin was much easier, because I looked up his police dossier, and that told me... John, before you became an actor, writer, and comedian, you were a school teacher, labourer, and lift man.
Yes, which is a lot in one day.
Any of those jobs land you in conflict with the law at all?
No, I've stayed well on the right side of the law because my father was a policeman, but I was recently up in the north of England in a police station where we were doing some filming, and they were on a very odd case of a gentleman assailant who kept leaping out of the bushes and biting the local ladies. And a Mrs. Peck had been bitten in the neck, and a Mrs. Bland had been bitten in the hand, and while I was there, a Mrs. Glum came in and asked for police protection.
Now, you've heard the voices of our panel. The next ones you'll hear will be our Law Game Repertory Company as they lead us into tonight's first situation. This took place at 7 o'clock one morning on a piece of wasteland in Birmingham. A policeman patrolling the area came upon a car with what appeared to be a dead body on the back seat. But when he tried to force the door open, the body stirred.
Oh, what is it? What's happening? What's going on?
I'm a police officer. Open this door.
Oh, what do you want? I'm trying to sleep.
I said open this door.
All right, all right. Keep your helmets on. I'm opening it.
That's better. Now, who are you and what are you doing here?
Nothing illegal.
I'll decide that if you don't mind. Let's have your name to start with.
Alan. Benny Allen. And before you ask now, this isn't Marco.
I see.
But I do have permission to use it.
Do you now? I have a check on that. Who owns the vehicle then, and how do you come to be sleeping in it on public wasteland?
Belongs to a mate of mine, Harry Billings. He's letting me use it as a temporary home till I get myself sorted out. My wife's kicked me out because I came home dead drunk last Tuesday night.
So you've been sleeping in the car since Tuesday?
That night, yes. I'm not harming anybody. Just minding my own trade business. There's nothing against the law in that, is there?
Possibly not. Have you been leaving the car here during the day?
No, not here. Too many vandals about. During the day, I'll keep it in the car park where I work. I sleep there too, but I don't want to advertise me troubles to me workmates.
Can you give me the address of this, Harry Billings?
Oh, sure. I've got nothing to hide. I've got his car here somewhere.
While you're looking for it, perhaps you'll be good enough to let me have the keys.
The keys? What do you want the keys for?
So I can open the boot and see what's in there.
Why, expecting to find the crown jewels or something?
Could be. You never know till you look. Let's have them, please.
Here you are.
Hello? What's this, then?
Me change of clothes and toothbrush and stuff.
I mean under those. There's tools in here.
Oh, so what? There's always tools in a car boot.
Including a jemmy.
Oh, you mean a tire lever?
I'd call it a jemmy. As used in housebreaking. Along with some of these other tools here. Looks like I'm going to have to charge you with being found in possession of housebreaking implements in contravention of the Theft Act.
But that's ridiculous. Look, I know a little bit about the law. What if they are burglar's tools? A bloke's allowed to have any of these on his own premises?
You mean he's allowed to have them at his place of abode?
Yeah, that's right. Well, this car is my place of abode and has been for the past 5 days. I can get Harry Billings to back me up in that.
And I can tell you, panel, that Harry Billings did back him up. So could he have been found guilty under the Theft Act? Now, obviously you don't know the wording of the Act, so let me give you the important part of the Act that applies to this. And it says, a person shall be guilty of an offence if, when not at his place of abode, he has with him any article for use in the course of or in connection with any burglary, theft, or cheat. So what happened to Benny? Was he found guilty or not guilty? What do you think, Lance Percival?
Well, I know Harry Billings, and he didn't mention this at all. I'm interested in the fact that the car moves, and that at night the car's on the wasteland, and in the daytime it's in the car park of the place he works, I believe.
Right.
Which means it's an unfixed abode.
Ah.
Ah. And the other thing is the keys. The keys, I know there is a law that if you have keys in your possession and you're drunk in a car, you can be done for drunken driving, even though the key's not in the ignition.
Mm.
If the keys are on you, you're in control of the vehicle, shall we say. So I presume that there's a possibility with the keys in his possession, he might be able to prove that he was in possession of that vehicle and he was sleeping there, therefore it was his abode, even though it moved about a bit. And therefore, I think he got away with it. Does that make sense?
Okay, fine. So you think he got away with it. He's found not guilty. He's a got up. What do you think?
Well, I think he's found guilty.
Oh.
His real place of abode was his house with his wife. Poor sorry. And any, you know, it was only a temporary tip, I take it. And it was also Harry Billings's car. So it wasn't even his car. So it wasn't his place of abode, even if he was living in it all the time, which he wasn't. So I think that's why he was...
That's why he's found guilty.
Yes.
Right, John, jump in.
I've no idea. You see, you're very crafty. You don't tell us the whole of the act. I mean, who defines a place of abode? Does it have to have a room? Does it have to have a loo or hot and cold running chambermaids? Or what makes an abode?
What would reasonably be an abode?
An abode, to me, would be a roof and some place to sleep. But, I mean, I am not the law. I would have thought, on mature consideration, that a car could not actually be considered, in the eyes of the law, a place of abode. And, therefore, I think he would be copped.
So, we've got Lance Percival, who says he got away with it. We've got two of you. We've got Lisa and John say, no, he was found guilty. The point now is you've got 50 points each. How many points will you bet on your decision, Lance Percival, to start with?
Well, since I'm going to lose them, I'll only bet 10.
You've lost confidence already, have you? 10 from Lance Percival. Lisa got out.
Well, I think 30, because I think you're right.
30? You think you're right. Okay. John Junkin, you agree with Lisa Goddard on it. Do you think you're right?
I don't want to lash these points about with mad abandon. On the other hand, I don't want to Lisa get too far ahead. I'll go 25.
25. Okay. Here's the answer. Benny Allen was convicted. He didn't get away with it. And oddly enough, the one person who gave me the right reason for his conviction was Lance Percival, who thought he did get away with it. Because the judge did not accept that the burglary tools were in his place of abode, and he said that the words place of abode denoted a site on which the occupier intended to abide. Now, when he took the car to the site, he was intending abiding there, but then he took the car away again and put it in the car park, so he wasn't intending to abide on the site. He was moving backwards and forwards between a car park and wherever he might happen to park the car that night, you see. So he was not intending to abide on the site where he was arrested, so it wasn't in law his place of abode, so he was found guilty. Well done, Lisa. Well done, John. Hard luck, Lance, for giving me the right reasons but the wrong answer. So we'll take 10 off you. That's 40 points for Lance Purcell. We're down to 40. Lisa, I can't double your points because you didn't give me this bit about the car, you know, going backwards and forwards. So I'll give you a 30. That's up to 80. John Junkin, 75. Lisa Goddard is in the lead. Second case tonight takes place in a court. It concerns a Mr. Jordan who imported a large quantity of reproductions, that's reprints, of paintings and drawings by contemporary Dutch, German and Belgian artists. He was selling them at £5 each when Mr. Hoyerbroek from an organisation called the International Artist Copyright Protection Society brought him to court. Now, Mr. Hoyerbroek represented various artists who wished to obtain an injunction restraining further sales of reproductions of their work. And we'll join the proceedings where Mr. Jordan, the defendant, is being questioned by the barrister for the society.
Mr. Jordan, from whom did you obtain these reproductions?
A dealer I've been introduced to in Brussels. His name was Leo Schaap.
How many did he sell you?
His entire stock, 870, at £4 each.
Is that a fair price for a reproduction?
Yes, I figured it would allow me to make a reasonable profit and still sell them quite competitively at £5, which is what I've been doing.
Now, your deal with Leo Schaap, did you have a written contract or agreement?
I have an official receipt, if that's what you mean.
Does it in any way specify what rights you have with regard to the goods you bought?
No, it's just a normal receipt, listing the quantities and titles of the reproductions and the price I paid for them.
With no mention of the entitlement of copyright of the artists whose work was involved?
No.
Didn't you think that was strange?
No, not at all. I assume that Mr. Schaap dealt with the artists, and these costs were included in the price he quoted to me.
But he never told you that they were, and you never thought to ask him.
Well, I couldn't see it would apply. It's common practice, or so I had thought, for the person who manufactures the copies of the artist's work to pay the royalties, where they apply. He then includes these royalties in his asking price for the copies.
So your line of reasoning is that since you were merely the seller, not the manufacturer, you should be exempt from paying royalties.
Yes.
Now, when Mr. Hoyerbroek called on you and demanded a royalty fee for his clients, reproductions of whose work he was selling, what did you do?
I referred him to Leo Schaap in Brussels.
Who had already referred him to you, saying that your £4 to him did not include a royalty payment to the artists. Now, did Mr. Hoyerbroek not only tell you, but also put it in writing, that unless you agreed to pay the 50p royalty, you were prohibited by his society from selling any further reproductions?
Yes, he did.
But you chose to ignore that. Now, why?
For two reasons. Firstly, I felt I had proper title to the goods, having purchased them in good faith. And secondly, I had a considerable investment, which I needed to recoup as soon as possible.
So despite Mr. Hoyerbroek's warning, you continued to sell the items and take all the profit for yourself. Thank you, Mr. Jordan. I have no further questions.
I have, my lord. Just two more questions for my client before he stands down. Mr. Jordan, when you were approached by Mr. Hoyerbroek, was he able to show you proof of any personal entitlement to the copyrights of any of the works concerned?
All he showed me were his credentials as a representative of the International Artist Copyright Protection Society.
And was it your understanding that he was to make some profit from the royalties himself?
Oh, I don't know about him personally, but his society was charging its clients 10% of all royalties it managed to collect on their behalf.
The very point I was trying to make. Neither Mr. Hoyerbroek nor his society were the actual copyright owners of the works. They were merely agents trying to secure for themselves some extra commission. So I would respectfully submit to the court that their rights are not being interfered with, and they therefore have insufficient grounds for claiming an injunction. This case should be dismissed with costs awarded to my client.
Now, what do you think, panel? Did the judge in that action dismiss the case, or did he grant the injunction? In other words, did Mr. Jordan win or lose? Now, remember, it's not a case about who was legally bound to pay the royalty, but whether Mr. Hoyerbroek and his society, not being the actual copyright owners, could get an injunction to stop Mr. Jordan selling any more. What do you think, Lisa Goddard?
Well, I'm not sure they could, really, as they're not the owners of the copyright anyway. And I'm a bit wary about Mr. Jordan, who goes off to Brussels and does shady deals. Leo Schaap. But I think he probably got away with it, in that I think he won the case.
All right, fine. What do you reckon, John Junkin?
I don't honestly know. My only dealings with anything like this is with the PRS, which is the Performing Rights Society. Now, whether the International Artists Copyright Society is in any way similar to them or not, I have no knowledge. If they are, then I think he got clobbered. Because these societies generally tend to have the law sewn up about 111%. His presumption that the other man had done all this, I don't think is valid, because ignorance of the law is no excuse or something, so I'm always told. No, I would have said that the case would have stood up.
Right, so you think the injunction was brought in by the judge, and poor Mr. Jordan couldn't sell any more of his prints. He couldn't make any money. What do you think, Lance Percival?
I agree with Lisa Goddard, actually, on this one. Simply because she's so far-head. But unless an agent has a power of attorney from the artists, I don't think that he can actually bring the injunction. So therefore, I think Mr. Jordan got away with it, slapped away with it.
Right, so we say two fines for Mr. Jordan, John alone fines for the society. Now, how many points are you going to put on it? Lisa, you're in the lead. You've got 80 points, so it's up to you. How many will you bet of your 80 points?
Well, as I sound certain, I think I've got 30.
30 of those, yeah. Right. Fine. John Junkin, you're the odd man out. How many of your 75 points will you bet?
25 was lucky for me last time. I'll do 25 again.
You'll go 25 again. Fine. Lance Percival, you're agreeing with Lisa Goddard. You think that Jordan won out, could go on selling them. How many will you bet?
Well, I'm so far behind.
You've got 40 points to play with.
I'll play with 25 of them.
25, will you? Oh, that's what I like to see. A man, a real gambler. Right, let's have a look at the answer. The injunction against Mr. Jordan was granted. Jordan lost. Junkin
louder,
won.
Louder.
Jordan lost. Thank you. And oddly enough, that argument that Jordan's counsel put up, that the society didn't own the copyright, so therefore they couldn't interfere, the court said that since the society got their 10% commission on all royalty fees paid and relied on that for their business and their existence, they had a very strong business interest. And that was being deliberately interfered with by Jordan's refusal to pay up. This was the point. He wouldn't pay up the money. So they therefore had a right to an injunction restraining any further sales by Jordan.
That's more or less what I said, actually, isn't
almost
it?
Almost the very words,
yes,
John.
Thank you.
Almost the very words. So, 25, and for the... You didn't give me the interfering with their business bit, so I can't double your points for you. But it does take you up to 100 points, John Junkin. Lisa, you come down to 50 points, and Lance Percival, you have 15 for the next case.
Have you got any other kinds of games we can play?
Try this one. It's the final situation tonight. This involves the sale of a house. Now, people are very interested in this, because I'm quite sure this crops up quite often when people are going to sell a house. Sale of a house through an estate agent. In fact, it was two estate agents. Or was it? Now, this is the problem. Let's eavesdrop on the conversation taking place between Miss Radner, who's just sold the house, and Mr. Pickering of estate agents Arkwright and Turnbull.
You say, Miss Radner, that you and Mr. Richardson have already exchanged contracts.
That's right. I move out of here on Wednesday, and he takes possession the next day.
But how is it that we were not involved in handling the contracts?
Because the sale was made through Lipson and Browning. Mr. Richardson came to me through them, and when he decided to buy the house.
Yes, but we sent him to you first. Within a week of our receiving your instructions, we were approached by Mr. Richardson, and on August the 3rd, we arranged for you to show him around. I brought him here myself. You must remember that, surely.
Oh, I do remember it very clearly. You told me at the time that he seemed quite interested, but nothing came of it. He didn't manage to negotiate the sale. It must have been at least a month later, after I'd invited several other estate agents to try and sell the property, that Mr. Richardson was sent here by Lipson and Browning. And 2 days later, he put the deposit down and arranged for a surveyor to do a report.
Didn't you tell Lipson and Browning that we had already sent him to your house?
Yes, I believe it did come up in the conversation, but he said he'd been on their mailing list as long as he had been on yours, so it didn't matter. The thing that mattered most to me is that they managed to complete the sale and you hadn't.
But it was we who found the client and introduced him to you in the first place. Don't you see that? We established interest in this house. His second visit merely confirmed that interest.
Well, you should speak to Mr. Richardson about that. He obviously didn't want to deal through you. I don't know why. Maybe he didn't like the manner of your staff. But whatever the reason, both you and Lipson and Browning were given the opportunity to sell the house for me. They did it first, and that's all there is to it.
I'm sorry, Miss Radner, but that's not all there is to it. As I see it, we introduced you to the purchaser, and therefore the commission, a not inconsiderable sum of £800, is due to us.
Well, you'd better take that up with Lipson and Browning, because I have a bill from them for the £800.
That is your affair. Our dealings were with you, not them. You sold to our client, and you must accordingly pay us the full commission.
I tell you what. Let me get Mr. Bainbridge of Lipson and Browning on the phone. We can probably clear this whole thing up in a few seconds.
Lipson and Browning.
Is that Mr. Bainbridge?
Yes, speaking.
Ah, Mr. Bainbridge, this is Helen Radnor. It's about your bill for £800.
The standard amount for a house at that price. I did tell you what our charge would be, Miss Radnor.
I'm not querying the amount. It's just that I'm not sure who it's supposed to be paid to. You see, I have Mr. Pickering here of Arkwright and Turnbull, and as you know, they sent Mr. Richardson to me a month before you did.
And they had that month in which to complete the sale. If they failed, that's their misfortune. We made the sale for you.
But he was their client first. Look, to save a lot of problems, Mr. Bainbridge, why don't we agree to split the fee and I'll pay you £400 each?
Impossible. Richardson was ours.
Sorry, we are not having that. The whole commission is owed to us.
But what do I do then? I can't pay you both.
It's up to you, Miss Radnor. All I can say is that unless we get the full £800 for our work, we shall have no alternative but to sue you for it.
Sue me?
And that's our position too, I'm afraid. £800, or we sue.
I see. Well, I don't object to paying one of you the £800, so I think the best thing I can do is let you both sue me.
The incredible thing is that both of them did. Both of them sued her for £800. Now, who won or who lost the case? John Duncan, you first.
I always assume in such matters that unless you sign some sort of a contract, I would have thought it's a debt of honour. If an agent who is not my agent gets me a job, I don't think I am legally bound to pay him a percentage of my earnings unless I have signed a contract stipulating that he is entitled to that. Now, I would have thought this case depended entirely on whether the lady had actually signed anything with either of those two people. If she hadn't signed anything, I would have thought she was free and clear to pay only the firm who'd come through.
So you would go for Lipson and Browning, the second firm, the one who concluded the
Yes,
deal
I would.
All right, fair enough. Now, Lance Percival.
First of all, for those people who are worried about buying a house, would you please note not to deal at all with Lipson and Browning or Arkwright and Turnbull? Mr. Bainbridge, who, by the way, takes an awful long time to answer the phone, he made a point about a month, the fact that he had a month. Now, that, I think, is an important point. And if at this time I've got the wrong answer but the right reason, I do want a couple of points. Because I think there's something in that month, the fact that the other people had a month to sell it and didn't sell it during that month, to Mr. Richardson, there must be something in law about that month. Now, I don't know whether there is something in that law, but if he's telling the truth and there is something in that law, therefore, Lipson and Browning get the full amount.
Should get their full amount. Right, you fine for Lipson and Browning as well. Lisa Goddard, who do you fine for?
Well, I fine for Lipson and Browning as well. Only frightfully unfair if the other lot got it, quite frankly. They did have a month to complete the sale. They didn't do anything about it. That's why I fine for Lipson
and Browning. You fine for Lipson and Browning. So all three of you fine for Lipson and Browning. And this is very interesting, because look at the points. John Junkin is the richest. He's got 100 points. Lisa Goddard has got 50. And Lance Purcell has got 15. You're all fining for Lipson and Browning. How many will you bet John Junkin of your 100 points?
Well, we're all going the same way, aren't we? So
yes.
If I bet 45 and I'm wrong,
you'll be finished out with 55.
Yes. And if no matter what Lisa bets, if she's going the same way as me, she can't get more than 50. So I'll bet 45.
45. You'll bet 45 points. Yes. Lisa Goddard, you have 50 points. How many will you bet?
Well, I got totally confused during that, but I think I'll bet 30 again.
You'll bet 30. Junkin has upset you, has he, with all his calculations? Lance Percival, for you, the world is your oyster. You have 15 points.
Well, now, if I got the answer right and got all the reasons correct, I would still be about 100 points. So I will be a sportsman of this and really gamble. Out of the 15, I will bet all 14.
All 14 out of 15, right. So and you all found for Lipson and Browning, but the judge found for Arkwright and Turnbull.
The man is obviously senile and should be removed from the bench.
Absolutely right.
Well, he said, you see, he said that Arkwright and Turnbull's work was the operative cause of the sale. And he therefore ordered Miss Radnor to pay them the £800. They had first put Miss Radnor and Richardson in touch with one another, so therefore they were entitled to the commission and not
Lipson and Browning.
Oh, I think that's
fine. Man's a fool.
An idiot. An idiot. Get him off the bench. Meantime, can I say, John Junkin, you are the winner with 55 points. Lisa Goddard. Lisa Goddard comes a very close second with 20 points. Lance Percival has his finger up and he's absolutely right. He has 1 point. But I thought you were all so good, I'll ask you back next week. Well, that's all the cases we have time for tonight, but don't rush and put the kettle on yet, because I just want to give you some brief details on one of the cases we'll deal with next week. It concerns a lady who saw a car she liked at an auction, where it failed to reach its reserve price and wasn't sold. She later bought it privately from the owner, and soon after that it fell to pieces. Now, was the lady still covered by the terms of the auction sale where she first made the offer for it? Think about that one. Then come back next week and see if you were right. Until then, let me just say goodnight on behalf of tonight's panel of Lance Percival, Lisa Goddard and John Junkin, our Law Game Repertory Company of David Bradshaw, Frank Shelley and Jenny Goosens, deviser and writer Brad Acton, legal advisor Doug Cracknell, producer Paul Mayhew Archer and me, Shaw Taylor. Bye-bye.